Well, I wonder what you're expecting to hear about now. I don't suppose there's any prizes, are there, for managing to guess that one? You say, well, it's Easter Sunday, so of course we're expecting to hear about the resurrection. It's so familiar, isn't it? And we expect to hear about that, but what a shock it was. The shock, the unexpectedness. It's lost on us because it's so familiar, isn't it? Read about it, heard about it before. I remember last Easter Sunday hearing at church, the preacher said, when those women went to that tomb, they no more expected to find it empty and Jesus risen than you do if you go to a cemetery. That afternoon I went to a cemetery and it was quite a striking thing to think, oh, those women expected the same thing as I'm expecting here at the cemetery. There are graves. And there's dead bodies, and that's that. And you don't expect anything different. You certainly don't expect it to be open and someone's come out. Well, I want to bring a message this morning that's based on the Apostle Paul preaching something that was a shock to his listeners. It certainly wasn't what they expected. The year was 47 AD. The place was a synagogue, Jewish synagogue in what we now call Turkey. And there this early Christian leader, the Apostle Paul, was speaking mainly to Jewish people, and he gives them three shocks. Would you turn, please, to that part of the Bible we read, Acts chapter 13, page 1108 in the church Bibles, page 1108, Acts chapter 13. And here's the first shock that Paul gave them. The first shock was, the king has died. What a shock, the king has died. Verses we didn't read from 17 up to 26, Paul is speaking here to these people and reminds them of their history of Israel. He gives them an overview of thousands of years covering that long history the Jewish people had. And it's all pointing to, and it's all preparing for, and it's all focused on a king who's coming, the great king. They called him the Messiah. Simply means anointed one, because that's what they did with their kings. We would crown them, they would anoint them with oil. And the story builds up, and the anticipation grows, and wow, what a glorious king he's going to be, surely. When he comes, how splendid he'll be. And what a golden age it will be for Israel. People must have thought, with all of these centuries pointing to him. And can you imagine the excitement of the people when at last that king comes? Can you imagine all of the pomp and ceremony and all of the bustle and organization of the authorities and the leaders when at last the king has come? Paul builds up all this anticipation up to verse 26, and then the king comes, and we read verse 27. The people of Jerusalem and their rulers did not recognize Jesus, yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets that are read every Sabbath. Though they found no proper ground for a death sentence, they asked Pilate to have him executed. Zero verses on his life. All this expectation, and all we read is, they didn't recognize him, they rejected him, they killed him. How could this be? The Old Testament has led us to expect so much. Here would be the greatest king, the hope of the world, the one who would right all wrongs. He's even called in the Old Testament the mighty God. Think of that. The one who made us humans with all of our intricacies. And he placed us on planet Earth, which he had made, with all of its resources to sustain billions of humans and animals and plants. And he placed that in his solar system that he designed. And then he placed that in this galaxy that he had made, where it's just like a drop of water in the Atlantic Ocean. And then he put that galaxy in his universe of galaxies that he'd made, all of it made by him. Could he really be tied up and be marched off to a trial where he's mocked, and people spit in his face? Could he really have his arms held down, while soldiers drive nails through them and then leave him there to die. If we take in who Jesus is, the greatest shock in the Bible, the hardest thing to take in is not that he rose from the dead, but that he could die. How could it be? There's the first shock that Paul gives them. The king has died. Let's move on quickly to the second shock. The second shock is the king has risen. Now, it's going to be very difficult for Paul to persuade these people that Jesus, who was killed, was the Messiah, the king. He didn't look like the king. He didn't seem like the king. He wasn't the king they were wanting. Very difficult to persuade them. And so Paul comes to the evidence that he is. Verse 30. But God raised him from the dead. As we read through the New Testament, repeatedly the apostles, those early Christian leaders, gave this evidence that the message is true. Jesus is risen from the dead. That was their evidence. But there's a problem, isn't there? Do you see the problem? What's this problem that the apostles have got? They're saying something that's very hard to believe. Jesus, who was killed, he's the Messiah. Oh, that's so hard for people to believe. And they're backing it up with something else hard to believe, that Jesus, this man, has risen from the dead. Well, you normally, if you want to back something that's hard to believe up, you'd choose something a bit easier to believe, wouldn't you? And we mustn't think people back then, they were gullible and they were ready to believe anything, particularly not the Jewish people. Do you realise Jewish people back then, yes, they did believe that people rise from the dead. Everyone at the end of the world. That's the time when people rise from the dead, at the end of the world. Well, blatantly, the end of the world hadn't happened. It just didn't fit with their system of thought for anyone to rise from the dead now. And so the apostles had to work at giving evidence that Jesus had risen. What we have here in what we now call Acts 13 is a summary of Paul's message. And so we have one very short summary of some of the evidence in verse 31. Paul says, and for many days he, Jesus, was seen by those who had travelled with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now his witnesses to our people. Now, what do you think of that? Maybe you also find this hard to believe. Surely anyone who actually seriously thinks about what's claimed here finds it hard to believe. Maybe you just plain don't believe it. Maybe you say, oh, it says in this book that Paul claimed this, but can we really know what happened so long ago? I want us to spend a little bit of time thinking about that. What really happened so long ago? You see, it used to be popular to say, well, we can't know what happened back then because those Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, well, they were written hundreds of years later. There probably was a man called Jesus and there were these stories about him, probably some truth in them, but then people added bits on and it got more and more fanciful. And until generations later, the church wrote down what it suited them. It suited them to say Jesus rose from the dead, so they wrote it down. And generations later, when nobody could really check whether it was true or not. You used to hear that sort of thing said quite a lot. Not so much now. You don't really hear that sort of thing being claimed today by anyone who knows what they're talking about. Why is that? Because such early copies of the New Testament have been found that the scholars, the academics, they say, well, the evidence is clear. Mark's Gospel was written by AD 60. John's Gospel was written by AD 90, and then Matthew and Luke somewhere in between. And then there's that letter that we now know as 1 Corinthians, where Paul writes about Jesus has risen, and there are still about 500 people today alive who saw him after he's risen. And, well, that was written in the AD 50s. And it's simply a historical fact that the church, which started so soon after the time of Jesus, right from the earliest days, believed he'd risen from the dead. Well, maybe you say, okay, they wrote about, they taught that Jesus had risen right from the earliest times. There's no doubt about that. But maybe people made it up. Maybe those disciples did steal the body. Well, let's have a think about that. First of all, would anyone want to? Remember what I said that Jews believed? Yes, the Messiah will come and people will rise from the dead at the end of the world, which clearly hasn't happened. This belief just wouldn't fit with what people expected at the time. It's just not a viable thing to make up. And then even if you wanted to, how would they persuade so many? This belief, it started there in Jerusalem, right where the events happened, and it grew so quickly and spread across the Near East. How did they persuade so many people? It'd be so easy, wouldn't it, to show up any made-up claims, to disprove any story. It's bound to have a flaw in it somewhere. But people believed. Why? It was so out of line with what they expected, but people believed. Why? When people got killed for believing it, why did they insist on believing it? And then you've got to consider that if you read through the Gospels, if you read the accounts in Matthew, Mark, Luke and John of the resurrection, they just don't seem made up. Well, for a start, when I say the accounts of the resurrection, have you read the accounts of the resurrection? They don't actually give you this description of Jesus bursting out of the grave or anything like that, which you probably would do if you wanted to make such a thing up. What do they tell us? They tell us instead about a group of a few women who off they go to the tomb first thing in the morning and find it empty and report he's risen. A group of women. Fancy that. A group of women. Now, don't think you've wandered into some sexist institution. I'm just trying to make a point that back then, a woman's testimony, a woman's witness wasn't even counted as legally valid. They couldn't be witnesses in a court of law because they're women and that's just not valid. Well, you wouldn't choose them if you're making up a story, would you? You wouldn't say, and our prime witnesses are women. Not legally valid, but not to worry. And you wouldn't write, have you read through those accounts? Difficult, aren't they, to match up? You find things, and you think, well, how does what he says in Matthew match with what he says in John? And if you really work at it, you can, but it's hard work, isn't it? Have you noticed how they explain what the resurrection means? They don't really. It just reads like people hurriedly writing down, I don't understand this, I don't know what this means, didn't fit with what I expected, but this is what I saw. That's the way it reads. What sort of genius could make up these Gospels so convincingly, make them stand up to so much scrutiny, by now 2,000 years of scrutiny, make them fit with all those writings in the Old Testament centuries earlier, make them fit with what Paul wrote in his letters, bringing such depth of explanation out. Make them, well, who, what sort of genius could do this and yet be so crazy to get themselves killed for it? And then on top of that, there's the authorities, aren't there? Think of what these Christians were claiming. There's this new movement in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, of all places, the headquarters of Judaism, and it's claiming the Jewish leaders murdered their Messiah. They crucified the Son of God. It's no surprise, is it? The authorities were enraged. The authorities wanted to stamp out that movement, and they did what they could. But why did they not do the obvious thing? If they can show that Jesus, he's still dead, Jesus never rose, the movement would fizzle out. We'd never have heard of such a thing as Christianity. The name of Jesus would have been forgotten over a millennium ago. But for some reason, they didn't manage to point out the inconsistencies in the story. They didn't manage to say, but look, he's buried here, or to give the evidence, look, the body's been shifted. Why ever not? Why did people believe a group of nobodies whose leader had been crucified instead of all of the power the authorities? Well, you say, okay, they didn't make it up, that's just not plausible, but they could have been mistaken, couldn't they? Maybe they thought they saw Jesus after he'd risen from the dead, but they didn't really. Well, again, there's not much we need to say about this. You'd just face the whole load of the same load of problems again. And on top of that, well, so many people said they saw him. Not just a vague shape in the distance. I've been amazed by the number of people who've told me in some vague, fuzzy way they've seen someone, a relative of theirs who died. But it wasn't like that, was it? It was people on their own, in pairs, in groups, said, he walked with us, and he talked with us, and he ate with us. And the women who went to the tomb. How could so many make the same mistake and stubbornly stick to their mistake when people point it out to them? Look, you can't believe this. Look at that problem with it. Look, this is going to get you killed. And they stubbornly stick to it. How could they be so stupid and yet persuade thousands and yet write this wonderful book and yet begin a movement the authorities couldn't stamp out? Well, maybe you say, okay, they couldn't do that, but there is another mistake that might be easier to make. What about this? They were mistaken in thinking Jesus died. No, he didn't really die. Okay, he may have been crucified, but didn't actually kill him. You know, I was reading, actually, on this Friday, just gone, a website, an Islamic website, and it made this claim. It said, do you know why Mary Magdalene went to the tomb? Said she went to the tomb to meet with Jesus, who was alive. She was going to meet with him because she knew he was alive. She saw, as he was taken down from the cross, signs of life. And so she went to see him. Well, somehow this woman from a distance sees signs of life, which the Roman soldiers, they've scourged him and he's lost so much blood. And they've nailed him to a cross with the whole purpose of killing him. And they know what they're doing and they've checked that he's dead. There he is dead, but let's put a spear into his side anyway. And they're carrying him, but somehow they don't detect it. And Joseph, who buries him, somehow he doesn't detect it. And somehow in the tomb, this dead body, lost all of its blood, somehow or other comes back to life, revives, and somehow or other gets itself out of its grave clothes, and somehow or other pushes away the stone, somehow or other deals with the guards, and somehow or other, this miserable wreck of a half-dead person persuades lots of people he's the Lord of Glory. Well, I don't think I have to give you any reasons not to believe that, do I? So, since the resurrection of Jesus was not some myth that developed centuries later, since it wasn't made up, since it wasn't based on a mistake, what other possibility is there? What else could have happened? I can only see one other possibility, which is he rose from the dead. Jesus, who was dead, came alive again. If you don't agree, if I've missed something, please do tell me afterwards, because this is vital. Because if Jesus stayed dead, Christianity is a lie. If Jesus rose from the dead, that demands a response from you. So please, you must tell me afterwards if I'm missing something here. Well, maybe to hear on an Easter Sunday that Jesus rose from the dead is no surprise to you, but maybe it is a surprise to hear this. It's not just a nice story for people who want to hear that sort of thing. 2,000 years ago, one morning, in a real place called Jerusalem, a real man rose from the dead. There's the second shock Paul gives. The king has risen. Here's the third shock that he gives. The king forgives. Well, maybe you say, that's no shock, is it? The king forgives. Well, think of this. Nearly all religions say, do these good things, avoid these bad things, try hard, be sincere. Maybe God will accept you. But here's the shock. Paul says this, verse 38. Therefore, my brothers, I want you to know that through Jesus, the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. Is that a shock to you? Does that amaze you? God forgives. To most people, it's not even that. Well, if there is a God, I'm sure he'll accept me. God forgives me. Oh, yeah, there might be a bit of forgiveness needed. No big deal, is it? Why do people think like that? Because, well, I'm generally a good person, aren't I? And why do people think, well, I'm generally a good person? Isn't it because we set our own standards, then we measure ourselves against them, and we come out pretty well, don't we? Is that you? What do you think of yourself? What sort of standard do you use for deciding what you're like? Well, I'm better than other people. Which other people? Well, I'm generous. I'm a good citizen. I'm sincere. Have you ever considered how very silly it is setting your own standard then measuring yourself against it? Imagine that you're caught doing 45 miles an hour down Victoria Road. Now, I hope that would be quite hard to imagine, but imagine you get one of those nasty letters through the post saying 3 points on your licence and a £60 fine. How do you think? And you write back to them, 45 miles an hour down Victoria Road, you should be pleased with me because, well, I think 70 miles an hour is a reasonable speed limit around here on such a road, and so I was well below the speed limit. I'm a good citizen, you should be pleased. Well, of course, you don't waste your time. Because you don't set the speed limit, do you? And however unreasonable you might think the speed limit is on that road, you're getting a fine. And you're going to have to live with the consequences. You don't set the standard for life. The designer, the maker, the giver of life. Of course he does. God, the king, he sets the standard. And his standard is his law. Verse 39, it's called the law of Moses, because Moses was the first person to write it down. And you've broken it. Every time God comes less than first in your life, less than first in your decisions, every time you act as if something else is more important than him, something else is more desirable than him, what an insult to God. Imagine that you invite me round to lunch and I say, oh, thanks for the invitation, but I'm going to mow my lawn at that time. I'd rather spend the time mowing my lawn than spend time with you. I don't suppose I'm going to get an invite again, am I, if I say that sort of thing? What an insult. Rather spend the time mowing my lawn than with you. I don't really like your food either. But every time that we act as if objects, things are more desirable than God, as if other relationships are better than a relationship with him. What an insult. And you're breaking God's law. And yet, this God, this king, offers forgiveness, freedom from punishment. Not holding these things against us, but accepting us. Now, if you think about when a person says, I forgive you, maybe last week when it was nice and sunny and they're feeling cheerful and they say, oh, yeah, I forgive you. And then today when it's a bit more miserable and they're feeling down and you've annoyed them again and they dredge up that wrong again and hold it against you. People can be like that, can't they? Is God's forgiveness like that? Well, Paul uses a word to reassure us. God's forgiveness isn't like that. God's forgiveness is sure and it's permanent. The word's in verse 39. Let's have a look for it. Verse 39. Through him, everyone who believes is justified from everything you could not be justified from by the law of Moses. There it is, a legal word, justified. God isn't just an individual who may or may not feel like forgiving you. And yeah, I let you off insulting me. He's the judge. And the picture here is God's law court. And you are on trial. Are you going to be found guilty or innocent? Wrong and condemned or right and rewarded? And the standard is God's law. How then can you be justified, found innocent, if the standard's God's law? Do you know, one day you will be in that law court. What are you going to plead? What will be your defence? You better have a defence, haven't you? What's it going to be? Verse 39 tells us the defence. There's only one way to be justified. Verse 39, through him. In other words, through Jesus. Think of the children's talk. Think of those boxes. Think of that swap. Jesus has agreed that for all who believe, all of their past sins. Have you got sins in your past? You've got some baggage? All counted to him. All of their present sins. Are you sinning at the moment? Counted to him. All of their future sins. Are you going to lead a perfect life from this point onwards? No, you're not. Counted to him. All of those wrong words. Counted to him. All of those thoughts. All that dirtiness. All that hatred. All counted to him. Every time you failed to do right, you knew you should have done it, but you haven't done it. All laid on him, and he took the punishment. I'd love to speak about how can that happen. That sounds unfair, doesn't it? Too big a topic for the moment, but instead think of this. That's why the king died. What a shock. The king's died. What a disappointment. Has everything gone wrong? No, it was the plan. Because it was the whole point of him coming, to take the punishment for his people. Can we be sure that he did it? Can we be sure it wasn't just some horrible mistake and he ended up a failure? Can we be sure that what he did was good enough? Can we be sure that God accepts it and says, yes, that will do. That will take the place of my people. Of course we can. Why? Because the king has risen. And so all who believe are justified, are counted innocent, right, no condemnation. Well, what a shocking message Paul gave. The king has died. The king has risen. The king forgives. But it wasn't just news for people to listen to and go away and say, yeah, well, that's interesting. Oh, what a surprise. Never thought of that. No, it was an offer to receive. And it's an offer still God makes today, even today. Verse 38, I want you to know that through Jesus, the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. It's proclaimed to people sitting in this hall today. The forgiveness of sins. The offer is still there. Who's it made to? Who can be, this word, justified, counted innocent? Who's it for? Verse 39, through Jesus, everyone who believes is justified. What does Paul mean? Well, he obviously doesn't mean everyone who believes something or other. Everyone believes something, don't they? He doesn't even mean those who believe, yes, I believe that Jesus is true. No, he means those who believe. Everyone who believes, Jesus is the way for me to be forgiven. So I put my trust in him. He's my hope. He's my only hope. I can see there's no other defense I can make in that law court. He's my only hope. I'm trusting in his death for me. Is that you? Is it you? If it is, here's the promise. Verse 39. Everyone who believes is justified. If it's not, be honest with yourself. Is it you? If it's not, here's the warning. Verse 40. Take care that what the prophets have said does not happen to you. Look, you scoffers, wonder and perish, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would never believe, even if someone told you. Are you a scoffer? You know, you can be a scoffer either by laughing at the message or by living ignoring the message. You don't have to laugh out loud. You don't have to go away and pour scorn on it to be a scoffer. You can just live ignoring it and you're scoffing at it. Do you realise what you're doing? Now, if after the service you come up to me and say, well, that was pretty poor preaching, wasn't it? I don't know what you think you were talking about. Or you go home and you say, oh, that preacher sent me to sleep this morning. It's quite an insult, isn't it? But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter too much if you insult me, does it? But this is God's message. God the Son came to earth, suffered and died, and rose from the dead so that sinners could be forgiven. And will you throw that back in God's face and say, no, don't want it. Fine without it, thank you. What an insult. What an insult to God. Don't do it. But instead, believe and be forgiven.